You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening. I'm Josef Lentsch. I'm director of RSA International, and I'm delighted to welcome you here this evening. We are thrilled to be welcoming back a brilliant public thinker and educator. Adam Kahane is a partner of Rios Partners, a global social innovation consultancy dedicated to supporting and building collective action in complex social systems. Also, he's an associate fellow at Oxford University. Amongst countless other achievements, Adam facilitated the Montfleur Scenario Project, in which a diverse group of South Africans worked together to effect the transition to democracy. Since then, he has led many such seminal cross-sectoral processes throughout the world. Tonight, Adam's addressing the not insignificant problem of how to change the future. While we might disagree on how this may be done, I think we can agree that this cannot be done alone, and this is what his book is about, which I had the pleasure to read in the last week. So, good luck, Adam, and without further ado, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jasper. I'm really very happy to be back at the RSA. It's a wonderful place to speak, and I just want to acknowledge one of my teachers who I didn't expect to see here, Ari de Geus. So lovely to see you again, Ari. I've spent the past 20 years trying to solve a range of tough problems. With my colleagues and others, I've worked on climate change in my native country of Canada, on the transition away from apartheid in South Africa, on child malnutrition in India, on the civil war in Guatemala, on healthcare in the United States, and many other complex and conflictual issues in different parts of the world. And when I reflect on this work, I notice the following pattern. Those of us who are trying to solve a tough economic and social and environmental problems very often find ourselves stuck. And we find ourselves stuck for three reasons. First of all, we can't make progress on the problems we're trying to solve within the context as it is now. It's too unstable or unfair or unsustainable. At the same time, we cannot transform the context in which we are on our own or working just with our friends and colleagues. These contexts are too complex to be grasped or shifted by any one individual or organization or sector. And finally, the people who we would need to engage in order to collectively shift these contexts don't understand or agree with or trust one another. And so these days we increasingly often find ourselves in these stuck contexts. And so we increasingly often find ourselves profoundly frustrated and challenged and concerned. And so the question that I've been reflecting on and trying to work on and to write about, and that I'd like to speak about this evening, is when we find ourselves in such stuck situations, how can we get unstuck and move forward? 16 years ago, I was invited to come to the country of Colombia by two people who were trying to help their country get unstuck and move forward. I didn't know Colombia. I've spent a lot of time since then there. It's an amazing country, long-standing democracy, a brilliant entrepreneurial spirit, a wonderful culture, and at the same time, a history of decades of violence. Two civil wars, ongoing conflict between the military, narco-traffickers, gangs, left-wing guerrillas, right-wing paramilitaries. It's the only country I know that has an academic discipline called violentology. I was invited to come by two young leaders who saw the situation they were in as unacceptable and wanted to try to transform it. There's a young businessman and philanthropist named Manuel José Carvajal and a journalist and politician named Juan Manuel Santos. After quite a bit of effort, they managed to organize a meeting, a big meeting, with leaders from across the society, former presidents, church leaders, academics, NGO people, politicians, to talk about how is it possible to move forward, and in particular, could the experience that I had been involved in South Africa be relevant in Colombia? I remember, even though I didn't know much about the people who were there, I remember there being a big fuss about one man who had shown up that people didn't know what to do with. I later found out it was a very notorious and feared member of the paramilitary, and I only recently heard the story that a woman who was a communist member of the city council went to Juan Manuel Santos, the young politician who'd organized the meeting, and said, "How do you expect me to sit down at a table with this man who has tried to have me assassinated 5 times? And he said to her, "Madam, it is in order to avoid a 6th attempt that I invite you to take your seat." So that was the kind of frisson in the group. There were a number of speakers, academics, peace negotiators, and I gave a talk about my experience some years before in South Africa. The conference or the meeting was being broadcast to the illegal guerrillas who were in the hills outside of Bogota. And at the end of my talk, somebody's cell phone rang, and it was one of the guerrillas who had a question for the speaker. And the question was one that I didn't have in my frequently asked questions. The question was, "Mr. Kahane, do we have to agree to a ceasefire in order to participate in the scenario workshops you're discussing?" And people looked at me as though I was, you know, supposed to know what the answer to this question was. And I gave what I thought was the right answer, and I think it was the right answer, which is no, there are no preconditions. What is necessary is to be willing to come and to talk and to listen. So this was an exciting meeting. People were interested in organizing this activity, and after some months of effort by a convening group that was established at that meeting, the project that became known as Destino Colombia, Destination Colombia, was organized. And a group of 36 leaders from across Colombia were invited to participate in this conversation about the future of the country. Cabinet ministers, business leaders, young people, NGO people, trade unionists, and most remarkably, members of the still illegal guerrilla movements, the FARC and the ELN, and the paramilitaries. To my knowledge, this is the only time, up to then and even now, that such people have participated all together in such a dialogue. The government was willing to grant safe passage for the guerrillas to come to the workshops, but they didn't think it would be safe, in spite of the very heavy security at the workshop venue, a beautiful rural retreat center outside of Medellin. So they ended up participating in 3 3-day meetings, 9 long days of meetings by speakerphone. The ELN from a maximum security prison at Itagüí, and the FARC from a secret location in Costa Rica. This was a remarkable group to talk. These were people who had never had a conversation like this before. People were both excited, I was excited, and also frightened. The room was about this big, and there were two speaker phones, one for the FARC, one for the ELN. And I remember that when we took a coffee break, people would walk out the door but make this, you know, this detour so as not to get too close to the frightening speakerphone. And early on, somebody came to me at a break and said, Adam, we're actually quite frightened to be talking to these people. You know, who knows what would happen to us if we said the wrong thing. And so when the meeting resumed, I raised this issue in the group as a whole. I said, somebody's told me that they find this encounter frightening. And there, after a very interesting discussion ensued, and Francisco Galan, who was one of the ELN people in jail, said, Mr. Kahane, why are you surprised that people in this room are frightened? People everywhere in Colombia are frightened. And so this idea that in some sense the dynamic that we were trying to understand and work with in the larger system was present in the smaller system. And the group developed a set of ground rules for their work together, amongst others, that nobody would be killed for anything they said in the meeting, I mean outside the meeting, usual rules applied. But in addition to that, that people would speak frankly, that they would be concise, that they would not personalize things. And if you look at the report of the Destino Colombia group, they were as proud of the ground rules they had established to create this safe space as they were of the substantive work they did on the future of the country. And so gradually, this space became a space where people could speak honestly and could start to see and unpack and make sense of the dynamics of what was going on in the country. And now at the coffee breaks, people would get their coffee and come sit next to the speakerphones and continue the conversation with their friends on the other end of the line. One of the things I noticed, and I've always thought this was significant, as I got to know the people in the group, I realized that maybe a third of the members of the group had suffered very directly from the terrible violence. Somebody's sister had been kidnapped because of his own political work. Somebody's son had been murdered, etc. And what I found so striking and so deeply touching is, without exception, it was the people who had been most grievously hurt by the situation in the country, who were the most open, open-minded and open-hearted, and were the channel through which the work, the group was able to do its work. After these three meetings, the group came up with or agreed a set of scenarios, a set of stories about how the violence in Colombia could be or might unfold. There was a scenario, they were all given the names of well-known proverbs or sayings in Spanish, but the English names were, the first one was called Tomorrow Will Come and We'll See, a story of continuing to push off the difficult work and the situation in the country continuing to deteriorate and disintegrate. There was a scenario of a negotiated solution between the government and the guerrillas, called, in English, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, that a compromise where everybody gave something up would be a way to end the violence. There was a scenario where that compromise didn't work, and in frustration, the populace elected a government that attempted to resolve the conflict through military force, through pacification, and that scenario was called Everybody March. And then a fourth scenario that people weren't too sure about, of a bottom-up resolution of the conflict through civil society, called Unity Makes Strength. The group did not at all agree on which of these scenarios were probable or which were preferable, but after much, much debate, they agreed that these were four things that might happen. These stories about what might happen in Colombia were disseminated very widely. There were large public meetings in all the major cities. The summary of the report of the group was published as an insert in all the major newspapers. There was a two-hour television program. The stories were taken up by different organizations and companies and government departments. So there was a lot of engagement around these stories. And then nothing, or at least nothing that was visible to me from outside the country. I really never heard anything about it. There was an academic article written by a political scientist at University of Los Andes saying that people had been affected personally by the encounters, but that it had not really rippled out beyond them. There was a UN report on the project, the title of which was A Treasure Still to Be Discovered. So I thought, well, this had been an amazing encounter, a historic encounter, and yet it had not really made an impact. I went back in 2007, 10th anniversary of the project, happy to see my old friends, and I had lunch with a well-known Colombian intellectual and politician, Antanas Mocas, who was the two-time mayor of Bogota, a brilliant thinker, a brilliant activist, presidential candidate, and I was flabbergasted by what he asked me at lunch. He said, Adam, do you realize that we have been living these scenarios exactly as they have been written, one after the other? We had this period of tomorrow will come and we'll see. Then we had the attempted negotiation under President Pastrana, I think it was, that looked like it was going to lead to a solution, but then it fell apart in frustration. The President Uribe was elected. His militarization of the conflict was word for word what was in the text. Now, I was reading the report, he said, and there's a missing paragraph. It doesn't say how to get from scenario 3 to scenario 4. I mean, give it up here. I'd really like to understand that. At first I thought he was joking. I said, this is, you know, it's just coincidence. These are stories. This was work in a workshop. You don't really believe that these are being enacted deliberately one after the other. But he was serious, and I didn't know what to make of it. This year I went back to Colombia. My book, Power and Love, had been translated into Spanish. The president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, who had been the young politician 16 years before, kindly launched the book in Bogota, and I was really interested, on the edge of my seat, to hear what would he say about this work 16 years before. He had been involved in the initiation of the project and had then withdrawn, let other people go on with it, and I was surprised to learn that in his recounting of the history of Colombia over these 6 years, he took more or less exactly the position of Mocas. He said these scenarios were not academic, they were prophetic. He said it is good to know that the best scenario we imagined 16 years ago is beginning to be realized. And framed all his whole political project and the whole platform of his government in terms of in unity makes strength. So this was a very gratifying and surprising story where I, up and down over these 16 years, I didn't know what to make of the impact of the work. A few days later, I was in New York, and I met an old friend of mine, one of the great scenario writers in the world, Betty Sue Flowers, a poet, a student of myth. And she said, Adam, you have to understand, sometimes scenarios can be myths, can become myths. And myths, she said, give us courage. If it is true in the story, we can make it happen. The final piece of the story is on this same visit in February of this year, I met Francisco Galan, the ELN guerrilla who had been on the telephone for those 9 days, who had since been released from prison, was involved in various peace activities, gave me the impression of somebody who'd seen a lot and knew a thing or two about life. And he said two things that really struck me. He said, "It is easier to make war than to make peace." And he said, "The problem we have is that we keep telling the same stories and we keep producing the same actions. We're addicted to our old stories. We need new stories." So my conclusion from this experience is that telling new stories can sometimes generate new realities. Telling new stories can enable us to get unstuck and move forward. This was 16 years ago. In the years since then, I have with my colleagues in Rios been involved in similar activities in South Africa, in Canada, in Argentina, in India, in Australia. The main advantage of doing one thing over and over for 20 years is you have lots of opportunity for trial and lots of opportunity for error, and so lots of opportunity for learning. And what I wanted to share with you is what I've learned from these experiences. What I realize that we have built up through these experiences is a new methodology for getting unstuck and for moving forward. We call this transformative scenario planning, planning in the sense of looking forward and trying to make good decisions today based on a discipline thinking about the future, scenarios because it builds on the long-standing academic and corporate body of work, above all exemplified by Shell, to do scenarios, and transformative both in the sense that we're in this work attempting to transform the context around us, and the means by which we enact this transformation is by transforming ourselves. This methodology is really very simple. It involves simply telling stories about what might happen. Not stories about what will happen, not forecasts. Not stories about what should happen, not proposals or visions or positions, but stories about what might happen. Relevant, challenging, plausible, clear stories about what might happen. And in this way, building new understandings and new relationships and new intentions, and hence new actions. But the other thing I've learned is that although this methodology is simple, it is really not easy. And there's three ways in which it is not easy. First of all, in working in this way, we are trying not only to implement an idea or a way forward that we already have, but together to discover a way forward. One of the features of complex, conflictual, problematic situations is there is agreement neither on the solution nor even on the problem. And so essential in this work is the capacity to pause in order to advance, to take a detour in order to move forward. This is above all an emergent process, which means it's not predictable and it's not controllable. And for many people, including for me, who like knowing where we're going and like being in control about where we're going, this feels uncomfortable and difficult and risky. The second way in which it's not easy is that it requires us to work not only with our friends and colleagues, but also with strangers and opponents. We're working on effecting transformations that we are unable to effect alone or just with our people. But if you work not just with friends and colleagues, but with strangers and opponents, you will find yourself in real conflict, deep conflict. And for people like me who like things to be rational and nice, this feels deeply uncomfortable and difficult and risky. And the final way in which it's not easy, and this is the most fundamental of all, is that we're working here not simply to adapt to an unpredictable world. We're working in this way to transform a situation which we find to be unacceptable, unstable, unsustainable. In this way, transformative scenario planning takes conventional scenario planning and turns it exactly on its head. And what's required is exactly the discernment which Reinhold Niebuhr pointed to in this very famous invocation, Lord, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And so this is really the most difficult part of this work. Asking yourself, am I in a situation that I need to accept, that I'm willing to accept, and I will try to be serene, or am I in a situation which is unacceptable, unfair, unsustainable, and I need the courage to change? And this here is where the real difference between advisors and actors comes into the story. There's that joke that what's the different contribution in a ham omelet, what's the difference in the contribution of the chicken and the pig? The chicken is involved, the pig is committed. And this is the big difference if you're trying to affect systemic transformation between being an observer, an advisor, and being an actor. Are you willing to be committed? And for people, for many people, including people like me, who are used to standing on the sidelines, this is profoundly uncomfortable and difficult and risky. So my conclusion is that increasingly often when we try to solve tough problems, we get stuck. Transformative scenario planning offers us one way to get unstuck and to move forward. It's simple, but it's not easy. It requires us to be willing and able to stretch, to have the courage to try to not simply adapt to our context, but to transform it, not simply to work with our friends and colleagues, but also with strangers and opponents, not simply to implement, but to discover a new way forward. But these days, it is exactly this stretching, this uncomfortable, difficult, risky stretching that is needed of us. This is how we can create better futures. Thank you very much.
So I really like the notion how you talked about myth and stories and how we can make things happen, make things real if we can tell a story about it. Now, on the macro level, I think a lot of people in the Western democracies, and I know you worked a lot in Africa and in South America and other places, but for example in the UK and in Europe, still feel that there is this kind of, there is a big narrative coming to an end. Something is ending, which is quite certain. At the same time, what's the new story? What's the next story? What is the big vision? One feels politicians are only working from kind of one week to the next, and those myths, those narratives are not there anymore. So how do you see something like transformative scenario planning potentially addressing one of those big issues, the crisis of capitalism, for example?
Well, I think there's lots of ways in which our existing stories are not working well, and this is why I found Francisco Galán's comments so riveting, that they're not working and yet we're addicted to them, and waiting for somebody else to come up with this new story for us doesn't seem like what our time calls for. So in a way, I mean, transformative scenario planning is a phrase with a lot of syllables in it, but the essence of what I'm talking about is, can we together create new stories or explore new stories? And the reason I use the Columbia example is because it shows the dynamics of this process in very bright colors. But I'm arguing that the same dynamics of stories that not working, polarization, fragmentation, demonization is occurring in much more ordinary contexts. It's just, they're just harder to see. And that whether it is something big like the future of capitalism or something specific like the future of our community or our school, this is the work that's required when the stories aren't working anymore.
Mm-hmm. So in your book, which I very much enjoyed, which is very accessible, you write about the stages, the different stages of transformative scenario planning, one of them being the convening the team to do the process. And you write that the biggest challenge is that some of the people that you think should be involved, by the nature of their role, of their position, sometimes do not want to be involved.
Yeah.
And then you say, so you need to you need to search for people who might be more open, who might be ready to kind of take part. Now, my question is, that means potentially that you might end up with, you know, the people who are more accessible, more open, but not necessarily the most powerful
yeah.
ones. So, if in your experience, what does this trade-off mean? In how far does this have an adverse or not an adverse effect on the process?
Yeah, the book I spoke about before at the RSA, Power and Love, is a philosophical reflection, and I wanted to write a small book that was very practical. So it lays out five steps, convene a team from across the whole system, observe what is happening, construct stories about what might happen, discover what can and must be done, and act to change the system. But you're correct to focus on that first step. It's the most important, or the most challenging, because it's first and because it sets the pattern for everything that follows. And you've put your finger on the most challenging part of the most challenging step, which is, how do you find a group of leaders who together have the capacity to shift the system, who are willing to work together to do so? Does it need to be as extreme a crisis as was the case in Colombia in 1996? And the most frequent difficulty is to name it, is that often the people for whom the current system is working well are not interested in engaging in activities to change the system. And this, of course, is the issue I wanted to focus on by writing not simply about love, but about power and love. And so this really is the challenge. And it may be a question of persistence. It may be a question of timing. It may be a question of using other social change approaches, organizing approaches, collective action approaches, in order to create a context where enough people realize this really isn't working. And let's see if there's a way forward. And once that bridge has been crossed, then this approach, this story-based approach, this discovery-based approach, this dialogue-based approach can be useful. But the precondition is that there is a critical mass of people who agree that the situation is problematic. They may not have the same definition of the problem, but in different ways and from different perspectives, they agree that the current situation is problematic. That's enough to start. That's enough to start. And the reason I have found this work so difficult, for example, in my own country of Canada, is that the system is working for many people. And therefore, it's fine up to a point, but when you get to really having to stretch in your thinking or your relating or your intention or your actions, people say, well, actually, I'll bow out now.
So is the crisis, in a way, perhaps not painful enough?
Yes.
So my last question, and then it's over to you, related to the last point. So you talk about the difference of adaptive scenario planning, which you did at the legendary Shell unit, and transformational, is that It's not about being disinterested and kind of just envisioning what could happen, but basically making it happen, transforming it, and thereby transforming oneself. Now, how do you see the relation of, as a facilitator, the importance of being disinterested and basically efficacy being based on being disinterested versus being an agent of change, being this kind of transformational entrepreneur and potentially then leading to resistance in the system because one is so passionate about an issue?
Well, this work is full of paradoxes. But yes, the main point of the book is that there is a fundamental difference between telling stories about the future so as to be able to adapt to a future which can't be predicted, can't be controlled, and that you needn't try to change, compared to telling stories about the future in order to contribute to influencing what would change. And therein lies a whole different enterprise, and that's what I'm trying to clarify in this book. And therein lies an entirely different energy. This is what was so riveting to me about the experience in South Africa. I was working at Shell, loving it, and when I flew from London to Cape Town to facilitate the Montfleur exercises, we used exactly the same methodology, word for word, the same methodology, and something was different. And my conclusion is what was different was not the methodology, but the purpose. And the actors in the South African case had come together not because they wanted to just think about or understand or adapt to what might happen, but because they wanted to create a different future. At the same time, my role as the facilitator was entirely to be neutral. Let's not get our jobs confused. In that room, there are lots of people who have strong opinions about what is happening or might happen or should happen. That's not my job. And so one of the core paradoxes in this work, which extends not just to the facilitator but to everybody involved, is how to be both passionate and dispassionate, or to sequence dispassion and passion. The whole beauty of the storytelling approach is we're starting off completely dispassionately. What might happen? The question about what you want to happen, what you like or don't like, what you want or don't want, is completely off the table. We'd be chasing our own tail. And yet, once the stories are there, to be able to step back and say, okay, this is where we are. This is the situation we're in. What do we want? What should we do? And that's what had happened underground in Colombia over the 16 years that was invisible to me from the outside.
Thanks very much. I would have many, many other questions, but now it's over to you, and please.
Yeah, hi. Andy Salmon. In the scenario planning, do you use techniques such as meditation, taking imagination leaps, and visualization to actually take a leap into the future and get everybody to imagine the success? Is that part of what you're doing as well?
Well, you can do. Remember, this is not visioning. It's not talking about what you want. That comes into it later on. So yes, of course, there's lots of role. There's a role for being quiet, to try to interrupt the habitual patterns of thinking and reactivity, and to notice and suspend your assumptions. It is a creative process in the sense that you're building something together that doesn't yet exist. And at the same time, and my teacher Kees van der Heijden made this a point very clearly, the beauty is it is both creative and highly logical, highly analytic. This is what creates the space for such heterogeneous groups to work through how do we understand what is happening and what might happen. So, of course, there's lots of choices about technique, but I think these are minor variations on the main point, which is let's talk in a creative and logical way about what might happen here. And let's really try to see what might happen, which is presently invisible to us because of our assumptions or preferences or habits.
Hello, Adam. I have a number of questions that have come in on Twitter, actually. Two of them come from Jamie Saunders. The first one asking, what will future generations curse or praise us for? The second one, what are the deal breakers to shift out of the tyranny of the present? And I must admit, I think both of them came in before you'd said very much. So someone that's probably a fan of your work and had those questions bubbling away anyway. One from the Future Foundation, who I suspect is actually sitting quite near me, asking, what is the most important skill in successful scenario planning? Creativity, positivity, passion? And another one from Jonathan Carmody, asking, what are your hopes for international conflict resolution through existing diplomatic channels like the UN?
I find all of these questions helpful. I think future generations will curse us for how easily we slip into fragmentation, polarization, and demonization. This again comes back to Francisco Galán's surprising statement that as a man who's done both, he told me it's harder to make peace than to make war. The gap between the need for collaboration and our apparent willingness to collaborate is growing, and this frightens me. I have worked only a little bit with established diplomatic organizations, both a little bit with UNFCCC around climate change issues, and now with the Organization of American States around a new scenario project related to the drug situation in the Americas. And I guess my main takeaway from those encounters is respect for the work of diplomats. It's easy, or at least it's easy for me, to stand outside and say, oh, well, if I was doing this, I could sort it out much more easily. But when I get into the guts of what really are the different interests at stake and dynamics and momentum, I am impressed at the capacity of these individuals and organizations. At the same time, although I'm impressed and admiring, at the same time, their work, our work, their work, is often grievously inadequate. So this is a uncomfortable position to be in. The last question is, what's the most important skill? Actually, I would not have chosen any of those that the questioner listed. In my experience, the key skill is suspension. The capacity, it's not very complicated, but it's very primary. The capacity to take your thinking and feeling and wanting about the situation and to suspend it as if hanging from a string in front of you, so that you can see it, so that other people can see it, so that you can question it, so that you can look at it from different angles. You may find that at the end of that suspension and questioning, you think or want or feel the same thing as before, but you may find that you see things differently. And so this discipline of suspending and saying, being explicit about, this is what I think, this is what I feel, this is what I want, it's not me, you can question or you can attack that without attacking me, I'm interested in knowing whether this makes sense, whether this is working. This is if you can't do that, you can't get anywhere. So in that sense, it's the first step into any kind of creative and especially co-creative work.
And there's another paradox hidden there, because this is a skill which is particularly hard for opinionated people, right?
Well, I had a colleague, Louis van der Merwe in South Africa, who would advise people, if you feel very strongly about something and you're pounding the table with your opinionation, just put "in my opinion" at the beginning. And if that's not enough, put "in my humble opinion." And I like that joke, because that little phrase just reminds you, this is my opinion about things. I'm going to be explicit about it. And that little act of distance is all you need.
Hi, Perry Walker. I've been inspired by the Montfleur story ever since I heard it years ago, and thank you for telling an equally inspiring story tonight. I find myself particularly interested not just in the 30 people, say, who took part, but in the population minus 30, everybody else.
Right.
How do you avoid the danger that the stories are given to them, as it were, from on high, and is there a danger that people feel, well, not invented here, I didn't make these stories, they're not quite mine?
Yeah.
How do you engage them actively in those stories?
Yeah.
My name is Joanne Chetta. Thank you for your presentation. You describe a process that you repeatedly described the process as risky, uncomfortable, difficult. You described a need for facilitation that's alternately passionate, dispassionate. You described a lot of things. I just wonder, are we talking about a method here that's replicable without a you?
Thank you.
Hi. One of your first couple of questions that you answered on stage talked about the dependency on a certain number of people that kind of believed in change or somehow kind of engaged or believed in it. And I just wondered, in your experience, do you have a sense of the sort of ratios or percentages of people that need to be or to believe in change fundamentally for a scenario to change? I work quite a lot in this space in the sort of corporate environment, so I'm interested in the sort of the bigger social issues here and some of those ratios involved, if possible.
Rosie McLeod, TNS BMRB. I'm just interested in these stories of the future, do they necessarily entail how you get from here to there? Because that requires us to describe quite a credible change process. And if you're stuck in the present, can you start from there? Or is it easier to reach further away where these things could have been, where other things could have happened that allow us the freedom to think outside the box?
Thank you. I think there is always a risk that the stories will be seen as having been given from on high. That's happened sometimes. I think that's a particular danger in a cynical culture or a cynical moment. I heard this great story the other day about scenarios as manipulation from somebody in the State Department who told me a story about Henry Kissinger and scenarios. This person obviously had been there when Henry Kissinger was there, but I guess it lives in the institutional memory. But he was this idea that scenarios can not only be on high, but can be seen as manipulation. And Henry Kissinger apparently was not happy when his staff presented scenarios to him. He said typically they would give him one scenario of thermonuclear war, one scenario of unconditional surrender, and then a scenario in the middle of what they actually wanted to do. And so this whole question about how do you tell stories in a way that they can be worked with and that they're not manipulation. It's one of the things that's interesting about the Destino Columbia scenarios, to take that example, is that in a context where people could not see a way forward out of the violence, the Destino Columbia team actually offered three different ones. That was, I think, one of the interesting features of that set of scenarios. I think one of the very promising areas in which I have no experience but I'm really interested is with social media and with is there a way to do this work that engages in the co-creation much, much larger groups of people? I don't know how to do that, but I think we can do things now that we couldn't do 20 years ago. Absolutely, the method is replicable. And I've deliberately written the book so as to replicate it. Maybe I exaggerate the way in which this is difficult, and I realize from your question that maybe I've been misunderstood. It's just because I know how often we and I fail in this work. I don't want to be misunderstood as saying it's easy or that it's a silver bullet. So that's the reason I emphasize it, and also to emphasize that there is both an outer game of this work, a series of steps, a series of conditions, a series of techniques, and an inner game, an interior work to do this, which involves some of the things we've been talking about, passion and dispassion, suspension, etc. But my whole objective in writing the book is to make this replicable. I've worked a bit in India with a man named Arun Myra, who said to me a couple of years ago, Adam, it's fine that we have this technique that works in elite groups. I think you should write a book that could be used in every village. And this is what I was trying to do. And at the same time, I'm trying to be very explicit about what is required, both in the outer game and in the inner game. I don't know about critical mass, I'm not sure. But it is important, from my perspective, to say it's not necessary to start with people who have a shared understanding of what needs to be done, or even a shared understanding about what the problem is. That's why Cees van der Heijden refers to these as problematic situations. They're not as simple as problems. But you do need, at least in the way I've been doing the work, to have enough people who share a dissatisfaction with the way things are that they are willing to begin to talk and work and act together to see where they can get to. But then the processes by which change occur in large social systems are difficult and perhaps impossible to trace out. This is why the Destino Columbia story is so interesting to me. It's so hard to tell at any given moment is something happening or is not something happening. The final question, yes, the scenario method does require you to tell a plausible story about how we could get from where we are to a particular outcome. There are techniques that involve moving backwards. I don't have experience with that. But yes, it is crucial that the story not be a fantasy, not be an image, but a plausible narrative about how might this happen. It's very, very important in the work.
Thanks. I think if I remember correctly, you're talking in the book about a 50% failure rate of the processes.
Well, I don't know the percentage, but it's a matter of professional integrity to be clear that these are not magical activities that always work. Complex, stuck situations are difficult to make progress on, and yet I think this approach offers certain potential, and that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Talbia. I'm quite interested, I think someone on Twitter also mentioned this, with regards to conflict resolution specifically, and maybe taking a scenario. How do we get maybe from a group of people saying that this is unacceptable, and maybe some one or two people in an elite maybe agreeing or disagreeing? How do we make that transition if we have a pressing problem like Israel-Palestine, for example?
My name is Catherine Dale, and I work in change management in the NHS. And so I work with doctors and nurses and other people who work in hospitals, and also with patients. And I was really interested in what you were talking about in the Columbia scenario, where people started to articulate the things that they were really quite fearful about. And sometimes it's more difficult for people to actually talk about the things that they're frightened of. And I wondered how important you thought that was, and how there might be techniques for encouraging people to talk about those sort of things.
Thank you. Question in the front.
Yeah, I just wondered if you could make a comment about the relative merits of an inductive versus a deductive approach to generating scenarios. Does one in particular lead to more of the kind of transformative thinking that you are advocating today?
Hi, I'm Catherine Ellis. I'm the Head of Youth Affairs at the Commonwealth. This strikes me as a methodology that would be very, very effective with young people because of their creativity and because of their sort of idealism for the future, and also a very effective way of having them engage meaningfully with decision makers. Have you done work specifically that sort of incorporates young people into the scenario planning that you're doing?
Okay, thank you. I'll take them in a slightly different order. I've never done work with a large number of young people, but I have often noticed that the presence of a few young people, or not one, but three or four or five in a group, makes a huge difference. And it's partly the creativity, but I think it's also partly the willingness to say things as they see them. And there's a, in one of my previous books, I tell such a story from a workshop in Guatemala where I don't know if naive is the right word, but the directness of a young person's statement about what he was hearing from the old people really shifted things. So I think there's a lot of potential there. Relatedly, I'm not sure it's essential to talk about what you're frightened of specifically, but it is essential to say what you're really thinking and to say what you're really feeling. And this requires a lot of attention to what I refer to in the book as a strong container. A container, the physical, emotional, political, intellectual space which is both safe enough for people to take a risk, but also pressurized enough so that to enable them to do that. And the one approach which I've used many times and have written about a lot is personal storytelling. So to say, we're talking about this complex situation of which we're a part, and we can talk about it analytically and with data and with graphs and with observations, but we can talk about the same situation through our own experiences of the system. And this is frequently very powerful in enabling everybody to see more clearly what's really going on here. So this is what is important. And if people are frightened, for them to be, if they're frightened or happy or greedy or whatever they are, whatever their thinking and feeling and wanting is, for that, for more of that to become visible. This is the key. I told the story in the Destino Colombia of the space becoming safe enough for one of the business people in the group to say, "I don't trust the gorillas," and that it had to be safe enough for him to go against the whole lovely warm feeling in the group for him to say, this is nonsense. You can't trust these people. I don't trust these people." And it took courage to say that, going against the warm, friendly feeling in the group. But it revealed an aspect of the truth of the situation, which was crucial for the group to understand and led directly to the elaboration of the Everybody March scenario. And I've always used that as an example of what happens when somebody says what they're really thinking and feeling, how it just clears the fog from the room. And this is not easy. And in some cultures, not going to mention any right now, this ability to be very direct is more difficult than others. This whole question about how to get from a few people to enough people or from a few people to powerful people is difficult, and my own limited experience doing work of this sort in Israel and Palestine has had evidently very limited impact, as have most efforts. I guess the only thing I'd say is it's really important to understand this transformative scenario planning as one in a very large repertoire of possible ways of affecting change. And there's times when this is helpful and times when political movements are helpful and times when backroom deals are helpful and times when mass rallies are helpful and times when poetry is helpful. And I'm just trying to add another tool into the repertoire, which I believe is useful in certain very specific circumstances. But just like this question Yosef asked about convening, this is always the, by definition, this is the the most challenging part of the work because it requires creating something out of nothing. If these relationships and understandings and teams already existed, we wouldn't need to do the work. And so this is the most creative and entrepreneurial and therefore unstructured or unmappable part of the work. Inductive versus deductive. This is an esoteric question. I write about that at some length in the book. These are two... I was responsible for a 10-year feud in the scenario community of inductive versus deductive. I thought it had been forgotten. I guess somebody knows about that. Anyway, it was a completely useless feud. I think they're both useful. I don't think I can quickly explain the difference between them, but to answer your question, the deductive work is more straightforward and the inductive work is more creative. And that's really the trade-off. I now use both or even alternate between them. I no longer think it's an important battle to fight. I've given up on that one. But feel free. Take it over.
Great. With this, I'd like to close the session and thank you, the audience here at the RSA's Great Room and online, for taking part in tonight's exchange. So finally, please join me once again thanking Adam Kahane.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.